from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made starting Friday with the launch of a new 21-day equity challenge in the greater Rochester region. The challenge is billed as a powerful opportunity to develop a deeper understanding of how inequity and racism affect our lives and our community. WXXI will be taking part, and you'll hear WXXI promote the equity challenge. This hour, it's a chance to better understand what exactly will happen. For the past several months, anti-racist education has come under scrutiny in this country. Historically, this kind of training has not produced much in the way of real change or results. This summer, the New York Times noted the following, quote, "One critique leveled at anti-racism training is that it may just not work." Frank Dobbin, a Harvard sociology professor, has published research on attempts to combat bias in more than 800 U.S. companies. Dobbin's research shows that the numbers of women or people of color in management do not increase with most anti-bias education. There just isn't much evidence that you can do anything to change either explicit or implicit bias in a half-day session, Dobbin warns. Stereotypes become too ingrained, end quote. Well, this is not just a half-day session. It's 21 days. And this past weekend, Saturday Night Live parodied white people who claim to want to learn more about inequity and the effects of racism, only to run when presented with a real opportunity. So what's going to be different this time around? Our guests this hour include Cicely Strickland-Ruiz, who is the COO of the United Way of Greater Rochester. Cicely, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan. Glad to be here.
Angelica Perez Delgado is with us, President and CEO of Ibero-American Action League. Angelica, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Sasha Mitchell is with us, a program administrator for the Racial Equity and Justice Initiative at St. Joseph's Neighborhood Center. Sasha, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Todd Butler, the President and CEO of CauseWave Community Partners. Todd, welcome to you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, we're gonna be talking a lot about this, and I want to remind our listeners, XXI is not only promoting this, we're taking part ourselves, and it's actually part of a broader set of goals that we have as an organization. We've created a WXXI and the Little and City Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Council, trying to implement diversity and inclusion goals and strategies over the next 4 years. We've got a council that's really involved in a lot of ways. And yeah, our council views this as valuable. But there's a lot of, I think, skepticism that people actually want to incorporate this in act. It's one thing, I think, to say you care. And that's why I want to start with the way that even SNL is poking fun at white people who claim they care. Let's listen to the product that they were trying to sell this weekend.
All these protests and civil unrest, it's clear that people are hurting. But how can I help when I don't even understand what some people in this country go through every day? I wish there were an easier way.
Well, now there is, with new 5-Hour Empathy.
5-Hour Empathy? What's that?
From the makers of 5-Hour Energy comes a brand new formula that provides 5 full hours of complete intimate understanding of years of systemic oppression and ever-present racism.
Wow, all that in one little bottle?
That's right.
That's great.
So, are you going to try it?
What? The stuff?
Yeah, the stuff I just told you about.
You know it. I mean, yeah.
Well, do you want to do that now? You did say you wanted to understand what was making people so upset.
I do. Wait, did you say it lasts 5 hours?
That's right.
Oh, yeah. I can't.
You're not scared, are you?
Scared? No.
All right, that's SNL having a little fun, but really sending a message that for all the white people who claim to want to take these trainings or they care, when you present them with the opportunity, they run from it. And Sasha Mitchell, I wonder how that skit lands with you and your experience when people say, I care, but do they really want to act or change?
You know, this is how it lands with me. It's been 400 years. 1619 products in the New York Times marked that last year. Of course, there are going to be some people who want to get this done quickly, but this is not going to be answered overnight, over a day. This is something that needs to be worked at consistently. This is an everyday mindful process. So I laugh at the skit. I had to choke back a chuckle. But we have experienced that. Teens are tired of talking about feelings. Let's just get the work done. That's not how this goes. That's not how this goes. And quite frankly, racism doesn't much care for anyone's feelings. Mm-hmm. It's not a thing to placate. So I applaud anybody who's hopping into this, but this is a time when you're going to have to put your gloves on, put your hands in the dirt and really work. It can be messy at times, but that's people.
Yeah.
But this is not going to fix with a one-day workshop. Yeah, we fixed it. No, you didn't.
Sure. Cicely Strickland-Ruiz, what do you make of that, the idea that some of the audiences for these kinds of trainings or these kinds of efforts are people who are more interested in checking the box than actually taking part for real change? Do you feel that people are going to sign up and want to really understand and then maybe put it to work?
I would have to agree a lot with what Sasha's saying. I would imagine that along the spectrum, there will be people that are looking to check a box and looking to do something that's quick and easy. But on the other end of that, I think that there will be some people that are really looking to be able to expand their worldview and to read articles and to participate in different webinars to expand their understanding. So the hopeful side of me has to believe that there is a spectrum. There will be some people that we may never be able to reach, but my energy and my attention has to be on those that are interested, and that's what we're hoping to accomplish as part of this challenge.
Angelica, how do you see it?
You know, to me, I feel it's time to just get the work done. And I think, you know, it's great that people are expanding their knowledge and they're learning more. We should all go in that journey. But at the end, we need to really look at ourselves, the organizations we run, the places where we have influence, and say, what can we change? And how do we put people of color in position of power so that they're able to be the driving voice for our communities?
Todd Butler, President and CEO of CauseWave, what do you make of the way SNL wanted to sort of poke fun at white people who claim they really want to do this, but then maybe run from it when it's time to really make change?
I think the best satire is grounded in reality, and I think there's a whole lot of reality in what they put out there. I think the idea that even 5 hours of that experience would have been too much for that person to experience, I think is probably pretty realistic. And I think that working with the willing is something that we always try to do. And as Cicely said, to find those folks who are open to this and haven't started their journey yet, and to help those people begin the internal work that can lead to external change is really what the 21-day challenge is all about. So I think creating something that's accessible, you know, some of the criticisms that Dobbins has about trainings is the compulsory type trainings,
mm-hmm,
where
right.
someone is forced to go through something. And that's not what this is. This is something that people opt into, and they do it independently to try to examine their own opinions and feelings and prejudices and everything else. And so I think that's where this work has got to start. I think if we could do this to people, we would have done it a long time ago. But I think this is something that people have to engage in personally and internally before we can see the change happen on the outside.
Todd Butler, how do people opt in if they want to?
So they can go to the website, www.rockequitychallenge.org, and sign up. Lots of organizations. There are, you know, that it's impossible to keep your finger on what the number of people are who are registered because it just keeps going up. But we've got over 200 organizations that have signed up now, and those 200 organizations represent 60,000 employees. So those 60,000 employees are all going to be getting emails offering them the opportunity to learn. And there's another over 3,500 individuals who have signed up as well without any affiliation from an organization because they want to learn more about this.
Well, let's talk about what it's going to mean on a daily basis for those 21 days. If you or your organization are getting started with this on Friday, as we are here at WXXI and many will across this area, what it sort of looks like and maybe also how the content was chosen. I mean, there's a lot of different materials from books to online training seminars, videos, articles, etc. Sasha Mitchell, I'll start with you on this. How do you make sure that what you're choosing you feel is the right material for this kind of training?
There's a selection process where there are a number of us giving suggestions to the material we're going to be sending out to organizations, but I am trusting that a lot of the information that we are selecting is based off of local area experts and the conversation that we've been having in our region. So, you know, for me, this is the beginning to not only just the stuff that is vital for people who are in Rochester, but vital to the national conversation, especially now with all this social unrest. There's ton of information, tons of new books, articles that people can read to really start to immerse them in learning this type of subject matter.
All right. Cicely, can I ask you, tell us about some of the things that people are going to experience or perhaps any of the panelists can kind of jump in this. I'll turn this to Cicely, but if you're signing up for the 21-day challenge here, what's an example of the kind of materials that you're going to start to experience?
Sure. So this challenge is actually, it was originally developed by racial justice educators, Dr. Eddie Moore and Marguerite Pennick, as well as Debbie Irving, who's a renowned author. And it really was meant to provide daily emails to individuals that would be looking to participate. So each day they would receive a specific topic focused through links to articles, to videos and podcasts that would really help participants to expand their own personal perspective, their personal understanding on equity. So through this challenge, as Todd mentioned, there's more than 60,000 people that have signed up already, but really the goal is to invite people to go on a self-guided journey. So this is self-directed. They have the opportunity to opt in and participate each day. There would be different options for them to choose from in that day. And really the goal is 10 to 15 minutes of content to really help to build the muscle memory of this habit of learning and seeking and growing and learning. So that's really the hope, is that people would be able to just carve out 10 to 15 minutes per day, put it on the calendar, set a timer to remember to do it each day, and they would receive an email directly to their inbox. And so as part of the collaboration, as Sasha was mentioning, we have partnered with more than 50 partner organizations to gather input. You know, there's a lot of organizations and entities doing some really powerful work in our community. And so drawing on their strengths, leveraging their expertise to really be able to help inform this challenge so that it's both educational, but also localized and it's specific to our region so that people can have an understanding of what's going on right here in the community where they live, work, and they play, you know, specifically around redlining or healthcare or education, whatever that topic might be for the day. So that's just a snapshot of what people can expect. But really the hope is that it would be 10 to 15 minutes, but it would pique an interest in that people would want to learn more and people would be curious, and that interest would spark deeper and further understanding and then eventually action, you know, and minds would be changed and hearts would be changed, and then action would result for people to identify what they can specifically do.
Well, let me just follow up with that point, and I'll start with you, Cicely. I'll ask all of our guests on this. What does action look like? Ultimately, if this is successful, if this 21-day equity challenge is successful, what happens? Cicely?
Yeah. So our hope, I'll speak for myself, is that this challenge will begin to encourage dialogue and inspire action. So people that have never used phrases like racial equity or social determinants of health would begin to use that kind of language and to understand how these systemic issues in our community affect people that work and live right next to them, that people would want to figure out how they can get connected with the different initiatives here locally. So as an organization, has your employer signed up for the RMAPI pledge, for example? YWCA does a lot of great work in this space as part of their mission, getting connected with them. So really looking at ways that this 21 days can be a launch pad to spark action. And throughout the challenge, there will be local opportunities for action peppered throughout the challenge so that, you know, on any given day, someone can choose to get involved, to do something, to write a letter, to get involved in a initiative. So that's really the hope of the challenge, that it would also spark action.
Okay. Angelica, what are you hoping to see change and come out of this?
You know, I think as folks reflect, I go back to what I said originally. I think looking at everything from the influence that we're able to have and really utilizing whatever influence we may have to provide the right opportunities for our community. So I know at Ibero, we've taken this challenge to really reflect on how the Latinx community can contribute, what are some of our own challenges when it comes to our story of oppression, how can we actively support and be more in alliance with our African-American brothers and sisters. So for me, it's really coming out with some tangible next steps. Who do I need to connect with? Who do I need to open the door with? Who do I need to make space for so that we can continue to make progress?
Sasha, what do you want to see come out of this?
What I would like to see is what my colleagues have said, but for me personally, it goes towards a wider conversation. So for a long time, people who have been in the know, they've been preaching to the choir, and it's sort of like an echo chamber. We all hear the same thing. What I would hope to see is that those folks who I normally don't interact with when it comes down to talking about race, we can now have that conversation from a different level. We can use the same language. We can have a different understanding of who we are in that conversation, and that conversation will yield so much more progress or so much more attention to dismantling how racism affects our organizations. I'm hoping more people jump into this and forget that they may be a novice, but they want to get involved in any way, shape, or form, and they get that excitement for it, just like I do.
Okay. Todd Butler, what about you?
So, Evan, I think there's a whole list of things that can come out of this. I think if we start that internal change work among a wider number of people than are doing that work right now, we can see people doing things like advocating with lawmakers for positions that they understand better than they did before. We can see people voting for people who support the change that they want to see because they have a different perspective and understand things better. They can stop being a bystander when a quote-unquote harmless racist comment is made in an all-white environment because they understand the context of that better and the importance of speaking up when you see that kind of injustice. They can understand better because maybe some of the materials are going to be about what it means to be an ally. White people can understand what it means to be an ally and then do the things that they learn in that. We can address the way racism shows up around the Thanksgiving dinner table, in our own workplaces, in our faith communities, and realize that once you know these things, you have a responsibility to use them and to do something about it. And we all have influence in these different spheres of our lives. And by broadening the conversation, we can actually take steps that lead to a more equitable community.
Well, don't worry, Todd. Thanksgiving is canceled this year anyway. So this summer, New York Magazine offered a profile of some of the most popular anti-racist trainings happening. Now, I want to mention that Eddie Moore, who is involved in some of what you're going to be experiencing if you do the 21-day challenge in this community, Eddie Moore was on this program 4 months ago. And if you want to look up that conversation with Eddie Moore, we invite you to do that. He had a lot of very interesting things to say. New York Magazine's profile was on a couple of different educators on anti-racist trainings happening across the country. And sometimes they're one-day seminars. I mean, they're not 21 days like this, and so they're not exactly the same. But the most debated aspect of the trainings based on the profile in New York Magazine was that there were two different ideas that sometimes seem to come into conflict, and I just want to explore that a little bit. The first idea is that when it comes to actually changing who gets hired, number one, who gets hired at all levels, but especially who is on a board, who gets hired in executive positions, the first idea is that white people tend to hire white people, intentionally or not. Even when there are qualified candidates of color or more qualified candidates, white people may not even realize certain biases and hire white people. That's pretty well established. I don't think that's controversial. But I think it certainly does bear, I think, either repeating or educating for people who don't understand that. But the second idea is that some values like rationality, evidence-driven thinking, work ethic, punctuality are inherently, quote, white values and offer advantages to white candidates. And New York Magazine writes that those ideas came into serious conflict in trainings where people were trying to understand, are we not hiring qualified candidates of color or do white people tend to have different values? Now, I think essentially writers like John McWhorter and others have said they don't really view work ethic, evidence-driven thinking, rationality as quote-unquote white ideas or white values. But this does get taught, and there is some tension and training. And I want to ask all of our guests to help us better understand some of those themes. I'll start with Sasha on this. How do you see those ideas?
I see sometimes that, I feel as if people, hopefully, the 21-day challenge will open people up to reading more about culture and racial identity. But what I do feel about anti-racism training and how it can bridge that gap between cultural norms as well as professional norms, I think it will help people to get a better understanding of why they are so adherent to certain cultural norms versus others, and then be able to look at, based on their industry, based on their system, what they might need to edit to be able to get a more diverse workforce that can then give them the benefits of having those different views and experiences able to help their conversation. But when it comes down to trainings in anti-racism trainings, I'm of the mindset that you don't want to halt progress for fear of imperfection. So that for me is in a nutshell what I'm thinking about some of the judgments around biases of people of color versus people who are white. Especially in the workplace, because I know some people who are on the minute who are black. But however, it goes much more past that. It goes towards how are you receiving that person and what is the cultural environment that they're walking into. So that's my thought about that in a nutshell. I probably have a lot more to say.
Sure.
I'll give it to the rest of the panelists.
Well, and let me just follow up with you, Sasha, on one point before I turn it over to the others. Do companies generally have, in your view, too narrow an idea of what would make a quality employee?
You know, I do, but I don't think it. So the problem is this. They're judging a quality employee by normal standards of professionalism that might be extremely antiquated, especially in the climate we're in now. So I'm not saying thank God for the pandemic, but we've learned so much about what we can do in workplace and environments, especially with technology is concerned, that when we loosened up certain things, certain industries began to flourish. You now have offices that are letting employees come in a more casual work attire. There's not necessarily a ton of cubicles, but there's a more open and free-flowing workspace. And then that idea of being on time or punctuality, it's kind of, I'm not going to say people can walk in late, but it's kind of shifted if people are able to do their job the right way. Scheduling is flexible. So what I've seen in a lot of organizations now is that when they look at how deeply entrenched their bias goes, they start to look at how they receive people as an employee, as a whole employee, not just someone coming in to type some words out on the paper and go home, but how is that person arriving as their true self and allowing the job to work around who that person is. That comes with understanding how biases are so entrenched in what we think is normal workplace culture. So it's more simple than just who's on time and who isn't. It's about how do we welcome in single-parent households or parents who are, trying to work around three or four kids' different soccer schedules without maybe another spouse at home. How are we working around employees who might want to be addressed in different ways and different names? It's about looking at how we receive that person in the culture and cultural environment of our organization. You asked a really deep question
no,
for a really small answer.
I appreciate that, Sasha. And let me ask your colleagues on that. Angelica, can you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole concept of white is right and, constantly measuring and making assumptions that behaviors from one race are held of a higher standard of behaviors of other races. For me, it's really about how people are inclusive of others' cultural diversity, even with my own journey. I remember when I first became the CEO of Ibero, someone asked me, are you going to blow dry your hair for the picture? Why should I? Who said that straight hair it's a reflection of pressure. You know, to you, it may look like my hair is not combed, but to me, this is my natural state. So I think it's really about getting away from that concept, you know, that white is not. I'm sure white people hate too. I'm sure white people walk around without their hair being combed as well. So it's really getting away from that concept and teaching people of color to just be comfortable in their natural state. You know, what are we measuring ourselves up to? You know, I always joke, you know, the biggest joke in the Puerto Rican community is we're always an hour late. No, we're not. You know, so we need to stop buying into some of these internalized racist ideas and biases that our current state has ingrained into some of our thinking.
Cicely?
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree with everything that's just said, and I would just add that you can't fix what you don't face, and if you aren't willing to acknowledge or address, then there's really nowhere to go from there. There's not any opportunity for improvement. So when organizations are thinking about their hiring practices or the policies that have been in place for decades, you know, what is that language really saying? And what is the retention policy for staff and people of color? What does that look like? What does promotion look like? All of these things are part of that, you know, that systemic issue that we keep talking about, that I'm hoping that as part of this challenge, people will have the opportunity to have their eyes open to some of the things that are just so insidious and have been a part of employment for so long that people haven't questioned. So if people are willing to really think and see and question things that have been around for so long, my hope is that things will begin to change. But again, if you're not willing to address it or you choose to sweep it under the rug, then it will never change. I want to just acknowledge Reggie, the Racial Equity Justice Initiative, that focuses on having internal change teams within organizations to begin to think about those types of things. What are the policies? Educating the staff. What are the things that we can do to provide education for the staff? So being able to really address and identify and call out those systemic forms of racism in order to really be able to make a change.
Todd Butler.
Thank you.
Yeah, Todd, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. You know, I read that New Yorker piece as well, getting ready to talk today. And one of the things that stuck out to me in there was there was some diversity of opinion on the among the people that were interviewed that talked about, are we about helping people to compete in the current race, or are we about trying to change the race so it's more just for everyone? And I think in a lot of ways, that's a false choice. I think we've got to be about both of those things. And I think finding ways to support people in being more successful in the race that's been that is currently being run today, at the same time we're finding ways to change the race to make it more equitable for everyone, I think is what I took away from that critique. And I think the fact that there's debate among really smart people about the right way to go about this, authentic debate that's not about dismissing the need to do this work, but authentic debate about the right way to go about it, is a sign of exploration and a deepening perspective in our country about it. If I could just add one thing to all the great things that my friends on the call said, the idea of change. One of the things that we've tried to do at Causeway, we're a small organization, only 10 staff, but we've tried to look at, you know, if we're not getting through our traditional recruiting practices enough candidates who are people of color who will add to the diversity we want to have on our team, then it's probably not because the talent doesn't exist. It's probably because we're not recruiting the right ways, and we're using our old models of recruiting and expecting to get a different result. It may also be that there's perceptions out there that, you know, we're a white-led organization. Maybe it's not going to be a very comfortable environment for a person of color to come into. So we need to do the work to diversify our staff in different ways than we've done it before. do things like examine the requirements that we've got for positions. Does this job really require a bachelor's degree? Because we know that that's a barrier, and it's going to make it harder for us to be as open to people as we might. Do we need to have flexible work hours for employees that is an accommodation that we haven't had to make before? Because if we really value diversity and we're not just trying to check a box and say, look, we've got a more diverse staff, but if we really value it because it helps us make better decisions and develop better strategies, which there is research paper after research paper showing that more diverse companies are more profitable, then we need to do that. Even if there wasn't a moral imperative to do it, which there of course is.
We're talking about the 21-Day Racial Equity Challenge, which starts on Friday, runs from October 23rd through November 20th. Todd Butler is the president and CEO of CauseWave Community Partners. Cicely Strickland-Ruiz, the COO of the United Way of Greater Rochester. Angelica Perez-Delgado, president and CEO of Ibero-American Action League. And Sasha Mitchell, a program administrator for the Racial Equity and Justice Initiative at St. Joseph's Neighborhood Center. We've got some phone calls we'll take from you on the other side of our only break. And we're also asking listeners if your employer has ever engaged in any anti-racist training, or perhaps if you're signing up for the 21-Day Racial Equity Challenge here and what you expect to get out of it, or what you've gotten out of past trainings, if it's been effective for you. You can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255. You can email the program connections at wxxi.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, candidates for New York State Supreme Court, Round 2, your chance to understand judicial candidates at length. Then, in our second hour, what happens when a black woman with a white husband goes up to a bar to order a glass of wine? The remarkable stories and perspective of Maya Johnson, someone you'll want to meet. You can do that Wednesday. Talk with you on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rich in Rochester is first on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Evan, how are you doing today?
Good, sir.
This is a great conversation. There's a frustration I've had in my past in watching people be hired, especially for minority candidates. I've watched them say that a person didn't have the skills they wanted, yet the person they hire didn't even have the skills the minority didn't have. Also, what I find is that even once minorities get into the workplace, minorities are expected to bend and to change and to be more white, and the ones who aren't, who don't do that as readily, seem to get isolated. I think there's a lot of isolation in the job, in the work environments that I see way too much. Now, I'm more engaging than, honestly, I just know how to handle it. And I always call it, it's a horrible term, but I think I've learned to do. Black people have to learn how to tap dance instead of black, especially black men. So I've been a better tap dancer than the rest of them. And a lot of people don't like that term, but I think it's very apropos. But I watch, especially with black males who don't do that, they end up getting isolated. And it ends up not being good for their career. And I see that way too much. So it's great that we have these the hiring practices to change. But I think also for white people have to realize that every black person or Hispanic person who comes and did a job should not have to bend to their will or to tap dance or to make them comfortable. I don't see enough outreach from their side. That's what I see. So those are my concerns. But in the hiring practices, I've seen things that aren't that nice.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Rich, thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
This is Sasha. Excuse me. That is what is, and thank you so much for your comment, Rich. I appreciate that so much. Every black person who works in corporate America and probably in a lot of offices they are bilingual. We have to code switch. So I know for me, as a black woman, I am expected sometimes, because I don't want to be seen as the angry black woman, I've got to be bubbly. I've got to be happy, so that no one says, hey, Sash, what's wrong? Just because I'm focusing on an email. I've got to learn how to talk in the boardroom so people can understand me better, even though I know when I talk like this, everybody can already understand what I said. There are times when, and I understand what he's talking about, that bending over backwards, changing yourself, morphing who you are. And I want to say that goes beyond just the office and work. That happens in real life. What I am right now excited about is not just the 21-day challenge, but in our country is a time where there's a light bulb that has gone off. You know, so I think of this whole time in our country as we've entered a dark room and lights are starting to come on. And as more lights go on, you see more things you got to clean up. That's what I think is happening right now. I am glad that he got on this show and let people know this is a constant thing that people of color talk about a lot. How do we survive in organizations who, for one way or another, refuse to understand who we are if we don't act just as they do? So thank you, sir. I appreciate you calling in.
Rich, thanks for that phone call. We did ask our listeners on social media, has your employer done any anti-racism training? Has it been effective? Brad says, yes, extensively. Has it been effective? Well, it's getting there. Jack says, yes, it was actually a very well-organized forum, free of judgment for us, where we could ask questions and gather insight from others. It's also an ongoing part of our culture, and resources are posted publicly in our office area for all employees. And another listener says, yes, we've had several trainings that were informative and useful. Tony says, I participated in a one-day training, and I learned that I'm terrible because I'm white. Okay, thank you. Thanks for that feedback. And Tony, let's address Tony's concern there, because you're gonna have inevitably probably some response along those lines. And again, the African American writer John McWhorter says that he has seen a double standard when it comes to anti-racist training. He says too often there's this idea of catching people in certain ways. And McWhorter writes the following for The Atlantic, quote, refer to a bad neighborhood and you're using code for black, but call it a black neighborhood and you're a racist. By Robin DiAngelo's logic, the author, you are not to describe such neighborhoods at all, even in your own head. You must not ask black people about their experiences and feelings, because it's not their responsibility to educate you. Instead, you must consult books and websites. Never mind that upon doing this, you will be accused of holding actual black people at a remove, reading the wrong sources, or drawing the wrong lessons from them. You will not be able to win, end quote. That's from an African-American writer, John McWhorter, about what he sees as some anti-racism training. And Tony says he went through one of these trainings and he learned that he's bad because he's white. Sasha, I'll start with you. What do you make of some of that?
I want to be brief because I want to give opportunity for Angie, Cicely, and Todd to speak. But I will say this. No one likes to hear that they've done something wrong. No one likes to hear that the book they've been reading at some point in time is no longer applicable to the test at hand. A lot of times folks want to be encouraged. That's not what this is. For centuries, racism has not cared how people of color have felt. If there is someone who feels as if these trainings teach them that they're racist, they're bad, that's not the case. I'm sorry that person felt like that. That's not what I or any people that I vouch for aim to do, is hurt anyone's feelings. But what needs to happen is there needs to be an honest understanding of what does not work. And sometimes I feel as if people conflate learning to be anti-racist as learning to be a better person. People are already good and can still be racist. What you need to do is think mindfully how you can regularly not commit any more harm. That's just for every American, every United States American. So that's what I have to say to that type of a response, is that it's not going to feel good at first.
Okay. Angelica, what do you think?
Yeah, I say the same thing. I think it's an uncomfortable place to be. I didn't realize how much I accommodated other people until I came to work at Ibero, where 98% of the people are people of color. I didn't realize until then how much every day I compromised my Latinidad, because I thought to others it meant I was being histrionic or I was being too aggressive or too direct. And that's an uncomfortable place to be. I mean, even for me in this conversation, I look at commercials now. I notice how many people don't look like me. So I can only imagine how difficult this is, I think, for the white people, right, that we're having this conversation open in an honest way. And I can see how there's this moment of awkwardness. But I agree, this is not about you are bad. This is your opportunity to really look at your beliefs. And you know, it's what value do you assign to people? So is it a black neighborhood or do you really mean a bad neighborhood? I think you can answer those questions about what assumptions and what beliefs you hold about people of color and begin to change them from there. But, you know, what the caller said, what Richard said really hit me because we compromise a lot. You know, we're really not allowed to be ourselves in or out of work. And that's a tough place to be. And I think white people are finally joining us, I think, in that painful journey in an open way.
Cicely, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say sometimes, unfortunately, pain leads to growth. So sometimes we hear things that we don't like to hear, and we hear things that may be uncomfortable, but it may be an opportunity to really hold up a mirror and think about, are there things that you are inadvertently doing that are offensive, or are you committing microaggressions without even realizing that you're doing it? And I think in this day and age, it's not enough to say, you know, I'm a good person. You know, if you're not actively supporting, engaging, advocating for, then that's just not enough in today's day. You know, it's important that people are identifying ways that they can be a part of the solution. And if you're not a part of the solution, then it's quite possible that you're a part of the problem.
All right. How do you see this, Todd Butler? What would you say to listeners like Tony?
I would echo what Sasha said. There's so much here. I would echo what Sasha said about, you know, not knowing about the way that workshop was facilitated that Tony went through, because, you know, it's something that attacks a whole class of people is not something that anyone would want to experience. But I think the reality is that, and one of the things that we've been talking about is we've been doing this work and I've been learning is, you know, discomfort is where we find growth. That's true if you're at the gym, right? You don't get the extra benefits out of going to the gym and not pushing yourself, right? So we got to get comfortable with being uncomfortable if we're going to grow. But I think, you know, Robin DiAngelo, who you referenced, Evan, who wrote The White Fragility, would probably say what Tony's voicing there is the definition of what she's trying to explain in the book, White Fragility. The conversation, if the conversation was about the impact of racism on people of color, what Tony's reaction, which was inculcated in him through the society that he grew up in, his reaction was about bringing the focus back to the white person and saying, I'm made to feel bad about being a white person. So now it's about me again. It's not about the topic we were trying to talk about, which is the impact of racism on people of color. And there are lots of examples of why people of color should be worried about making white people feel uncomfortable. That historically, you know, Emmett Till's a great example of that, right? But that didn't go away with the 50s and the 60s. The Central Park birdwatcher example is as present day as you can get. And he questioned that woman doing something that was against the park rules, and she weaponized that to try to get him arrested. So that reaction, it's a privilege as a white person to be able to say, well, I'm uncomfortable with that, and try to push back against things that make me feel uncomfortable, as opposed to what I've read and come to learn as maybe a more productive approach, which is if we make mistakes because not necessarily because we're bad people, but because of our influences and the environment we grew up in, if we get criticism from a friend or another person who's a person of color, even if it stings, it means that person is taking a risk for me. Hmm. And they're taking a risk at criticizing me. And if I can see that less as calling me the worst thing you can possibly ever call someone, and more as they feel safe sharing that with me, then maybe I can grow from that experience.
All right, let me grab a phone. A couple of more phone calls we'll squeeze in. Dave and Webster. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having this conversation. I just, I may be in the minority, not a pun on words, in the fact that I am a minority, but I work at a major commercial bank and have been in banking for the past 15 years. And I've seen a radical change in the past year and a half in regards to hiring practices, requirements, and some of them seem draconian, but the reason for it makes sense. And in the position that I'm in, I get to have these conversations on both sides of the racial, I guess, divide between, white folks and between black and minority Latino folks, being a Latino myself. And I guess one of the things that I just wanted to say is I've taken a number of courses. They are uncomfortable for, I think, all involved. And I think one of the things that I've noticed that's been the biggest issue, if there is an issue, is that it seems as though I'm having these conversations with colleagues who, you know, are white and saying, I have no opportunity for advancement. It's over. And it's not laughable, but it's ironic because it's just a byproduct of what we're going through. And it's a little bit sad, but just wanted to give my two cents.
Okay. I'll go down the list again. Sasha, you want to start? Go ahead.
I wanted to ask, when you say a radical change in their hiring practices, how so?
Well, on the requirement to hire people based upon race versus qualification. You got to interview a woman, you got to interview a minority, and then you can interview a white person.
I have a question. So, even with those changes, do they still, has that diversified their workforce or no?
I don't know. I'd be remiss to say that. I mean, again, like we're talking within the last year, I'm seeing this. So I don't know if you have data on that until like a couple years goes by. But the fact that is existing, that is real, it's draconian, it's harsh, but there's going to be a change, regardless.
So here's what I will say. I don't want to judge the practice. However, I do want to say that up until recently, every last thing or every different change still resulted in the same, still gave you the same result. So I'm a big person, a big proponent of not being insane. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. While I do understand that it may seem unfair to have to interview one woman, one minority, and other type of boxes you got to check, it makes me look at how big is the applicant pool. If just three or two have to be something other than what the norm is, and they still got to go through that because they didn't get any other applicants of color in the first place, it goes beyond just that rule. That rule is in place because every other step before that rule probably didn't yield the result that was necessary. And then it goes to who is looking at the applicant pool. You know, I think sometimes when those type of rules are instituted, an organization might be, I'm not going to say sputtering, but they're just at the beginning of making what real changes need to happen.
Agreed.
Do you know what I mean? So it might have to go to who's in HR? Who's in HR? Where are they looking at? I know tons of African-American professionals without jobs who are home from college with degrees. The amount of time that African-American doctorate holders remain unemployed is sad. And a lot of people don't understand that sometimes these rules need to be put in place because they give you this bill of goods. You're African-American, go to college, you'll come out, you'll get a job, you'll be contributing to your community. That's not how it happens. Sometimes that rule saves an organization, and it also saves people that need a job in their own community, especially here in Rochester. But that's just me. I don't want to get on the soapbox because you got a couple minutes left.
Well, Dave, I mean, do you feel like there's any common ground there?
No. You know what's funny is, and this is kind of my point, I didn't really say which side of the aisle I fell on it. My point was just acknowledging that I see change. Mm-hmm. It's occurring.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's draconian, but I also think it's necessary. And I think it's a necessary regret in a way, because unfortunately we're in a situation in our country and our world where you have to put systemic change in, and it's uncomfortable, as one of the panelists stated earlier. And when discomfort is when you have growth. So I just applaud you guys for having this conversation. So
wow,
thank you.
Dave, thanks. Honestly, Dave sort of held out until the very end on where he was personally on it. He was observing. That was a very interesting phone call, Dave. Thank you. I appreciate that. And now, Sasha's right. We're down to our last minute. So I'm just going to ask Cicely to take about 30 seconds to tell people why she wants people to sign up for this. Go ahead, Cicely.
Sure, just 30 seconds, huh? I think the time is now. I mean, we have a critical moment where we have a stage, there's a forum, people are actually listening, tuning in. There's a lot of things happening in our community that need change, that warrant change, have needed change. And this is an opportunity, a small opportunity for people to become a part of a larger conversation. It's an opportunity for people to expand their worldview. It's an opportunity for people to deepen their understanding. It's a self-guided journey, so people can choose to get as involved as they'd like. But the 21-Day Racial Equity Challenge is an opportunity for people to be able to understand racial equity further. So it's an opportunity to do something.
Starts on Friday, rockequitychallenge.org for that. Cicely Strickland Ruiz, the COO of the United Way of Greater Rochester. Thank you for the time, Cicely.
Thank you, Evan.
Angelica Perez Delgado, President and CEO of Ibero. Thank you, Angelica.
Thank you.
Sasha, you're right. We need more time. I appreciate it. Sasha Mitchell, thank you very much for the time and all of the thoughts this hour. We appreciate that.
Thank you for the time.
You got it. Todd Butler, President and CEO of Causeway. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you, sir.
We are in day two of our fall membership campaign, and I hope when I say member-supported public radio listeners that you have called 454-6300, and you are a member. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We will talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.